RPG Lessons Learned. When the game is over, when your players are gone, that's when lessons are learned. Hello, Brian.
Hey, Dusty. How's it going?
It's going well. So last week, we discussed Cairn of the Winter King. And perhaps not ironically, a cairn is like a tomb. And this week, we're discussing another dungeon that has, or adventure, that has tomb in the title. So Cairn, tomb, we didn't even plan that.
Oh, wow. What are the chances?
We're good.
That in a Dungeons & Dragons podcast, we would talk about tombs.
You know, pretty high.
Pretty high.
So today what we'll be discussing when we ran Tomb of Horrors, actually the word T-O-M-B, Brian.
Yes.
Do you say tomb or tome?
Tomb.
Tomb?
Yeah.
I think tomb's right. Tome's obviously a book, T-O-M-E.
Yeah.
Way off topic. Before we jump into recapping the adventure and then talking about lessons learned, RPGLessonsLearned.com is up and redirecting properly to the TFRadio.net website. So if you go to RPGLessonsLearned.com, it will redirect you to only the RPG Lessons Learned podcasts on TF Radio.
Instead of all the other podcasts that we do.
Yep.
Because nobody wants to listen to any of those.
Well, maybe not this audience, but I absolutely encourage folks to expand their TFRadio.net listening.
Yeah, I would also encourage that.
So let's jump into the Tomb of Horrors. I really wanted to run this adventure for you guys after reading an article by John Wick. And Brian, not that John Wick. Not Keanu Reeves. So John Wick is a game designer that I really like from his L5R days and a few other smaller games that he's done. So John Wick wrote a blog entry on his website about how Tomb of Horrors is the worst adventure of all time.
Really?
Yes, and he went on to expand on that. I wholeheartedly disagreed, which is okay. We are adults. We don't have to do the typical internet thing of burning him to the ground because we disagree with him on one point. He is a noted game designer. I am not. All hats off and all respect to John Wick. He's made some games that I deeply, deeply love. But he happens to hate this adventure. And I didn't agree. At that point, I'd never run the adventure. I'd only ever read it. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to run this adventure. People talk about it. It has a reputation. The first time I ever heard of Tomb of Horrors was during the Penny Arcade podcasts when Will Wheaton had an outburst as his character was dying in a pit of acid, where he said, "This is Tomb of Horrors," to Chris Perkins, the DM. It wasn't, by the way. That Penny Arcade podcast wasn't. He was just upset that his character was dying. But that's when I first heard of Tomb of Horrors, and I researched it and I read about it. And a couple of years ago, I picked up the Dungeons of Dread reprint of several adventures. So I have that book here in front of me. And before we get into how we ran this adventure, I want to read you one sentence that Gygax included from the notes to the Dungeon Master section. Quote, "This is a thinking person's module. And if your group is a hack and slay gathering, they will be unhappy."
After playing it, I can agree with that.
Yeah, the dungeon's all about traps. He goes on in that notes to the Dungeon Master section to warn people exactly what they're getting into. He says, you know, this is going to take a lot of time to run. It's going to take multiple sessions. Brian, this was three sessions for us?
Three or four.
Yeah, I think, yeah, it could have been four. Wow, it could have been four. So I recognized how different Tomb of Horrors is. So Tomb of Horrors is, if you've never heard of it, look it up, read about it. It's very interesting. It's an extremely trap-heavy dungeon that Gary Gygax actually wrote for a tournament for Origins, the first Origins Con. He wrote it to be especially deadly. He wrote it he famously wrote it as a way to kill high-level characters, because once a character got to be high-level in original D&D in first edition, it was pretty hard to challenge them with monsters out of the book, and Gygax wanted to prove that the game could still be challenging at higher levels. So he built this dungeon and populated it with inescapable death traps.
So I totally get the game potentially being broken at high level play, but there's a difference in my mind between fighting a horde of enemies and, you know, an escape proof trap. I mean, whether you're level 1 or level 20, you're going to die either way.
Absolutely true.
I think that sort of gosh, I don't want to say devalues the experience and the energy and the time that goes into the player. But I mean, I guess if you look at it this way, you know, whether I'm a level one human being like myself or level, you know, 20.
I would argue that you're not even level one.
Okay.
You and I are both NM. We are both normal men.
Really? So is that, dang.
That's a thing.
That's a thing. Okay. So,
well, it was a thing back in this era.
So, you know, whether you're a level, an NM player like us or a level 20 human being like Hulk Hogan.
There you go. The Hulkster.
The Hulkster.
With age, he might be down to level 19.
Possibly.
I think he's traded in some of his experience points to craft some magical items like tearaway shirts. It's, and
you know,
age has brought him down to level 19.
That's true. But like, you know, if he were to, say, fall off of the Empire State Building, that would be the end of him. Just like it would be the end of us.
Sure.
So realistically, I guess that makes sense. But I don't know. There's something that doesn't sit well with me about that.
So you're hitting on a couple of interesting things, and a lot of the points that you're making about how inescapable death traps, well, you're agreeing with some of the points that John Wick made, and let's talk about that for a minute.
Sure.
First of all, his proposition, and I think yours by extension, is it's pretty hard to have fun with inescapable stuff. Do you agree with that general statement?
So, yes. But we're also going to talk about the game we actually played.
We are. So that's my follow-up question, yeah. Is did you have fun during the game?
I did.
I think this game was a lot of fun for us.
But we didn't die.
And let's talk about that for a second. So I'm sure everyone listening who's ever played Tomb of Horrors, they didn't die? What? It's true. And there was no fudging whatsoever. But I will talk about, I will limit that statement with some qualifications. First of all, I had just read a great novel. Again, no relationship with this author. Never met him, don't know him. But Jeffrey Russell wrote a book called The Dungeoneers on Amazon. So I bought it, I read it right before we ran this adventure, and it was about a group of dwarves who specialize in clearing out dungeons. And they take a very workmanlike approach to it. They tie themselves together into work gangs, and they specifically spring traps, and they very methodically go through the dungeon. And I thought, you know, that's a really interesting way to take on a dungeon like Tomb of Horrors. And I thought I could totally, to John Wick's point, if you throw an unprepared group of adventurers into the Tomb of Horrors, they're going to die and then be angry with you because you didn't properly set it up. So I properly set this up with you guys. I warned you. Hey, you guys have been hired. I totally took Jeffrey Russell's setup for his novel and used it for my game. You guys belong to this group of dwarves that specialize in clearing out dungeons. You have wagons of materials and tools at your fingertips. And, you know, you go in small teams and small groups. You explore. You make maps as you go. Magically, pieces of paper outside the dungeon get updated with your learnings. If you die, your family, your friends and family back home in whatever dwarven stronghold you're from get hazard pay. We set it up in a very workmanlike way. So I was very clear with you guys, hey, there are a lot of traps. It's going to be dangerous. And I actually had you guys, how many extra characters did I have you all roll, Brian? Was it two or three?
Yeah, basically we had the guys in queue in case we needed to almost like a one-up. In the sense of like Super Mario Brothers or something.
Yeah.
Somebody just ready to take the start over for us.
I had everyone roll at least, I think, three characters so that we could queue up another band of adventurers if the first got squashed. We ran this like a one-shot. We didn't use our regular characters with this. And because of that setup and because of the workmanlike approach that setup encouraged you to take, no one died.
No one died. I mean, so... the way we approached it, yes, we knew that going in, it was almost like the bomb squad, realistically. Like, if you throw me in a room with a bomb and you tell me that I have to, one, avoid it, and two, disarm it, I'm going to die. But we went in, like, we've been playing a lot of D&D over the last, because this was a very recent game for us. We've been playing for the last 7 years. So we had an idea of things to avoid. And general best practices. So we employed all of the best practices and all of the care that we could in playing the game. And we had a lot of fun doing that because that was the framework that we were working within.
So you guys actually defined for me, and talk about bringing business into D&D. You guys actually defined for me, quote, an SOP, a standard operating procedure for breaching a door. Do you remember that?
Man, vaguely.
So you guys, I can't remember what the steps were. I wish I'd written them down, but so it was you, Mike, and Nathan that played mm-hmm. this game. Chris was there too. That's right.
Chris was there for one or two of the games.
For most of the sessions. Yeah. So four players, and you guys kind of bouncing ideas off of each other came up with this SOP for, all right, first we're going to try to unlock the door. We're going to wear these gloves. Then we're going to do this. Then we'll kick the door once. And then if we open the door, we're going to stick a weapon through the plane of the opening mm-hmm. to see what happens. And then we'll throw something into the room, and then we'll pour water around the crack. Like, you guys had this whole SOP. And then when you'd encounter a new door, you didn't call it every step. You would just tell me, okay, we're going to follow the SOP. What interesting happens? So it's up to me to say, okay, when you get to step 9 and you pour water around the threshold, X happens or Y happens. Or when you stick the sword through the door and an arrow shoots at it or whatever. But you guys, I was really thinking this was going to be a game of Lemmings where group died, the second group died. And because you were so careful in SOP, like, as you guys went around the perimeter of the dungeon, you were hammering, you were drilling basically holes in the rock. You were hammering, mm-hmm. what are they called, pittance, into the rock to look for, and into the stone walls, to look for hollow spaces, to look for places where you could break through into a secret passage. And as DM, when you guys start laying out very realistic SOPs, I mean, what dungeon can stand up to a group of determined dwarves hammering spikes into every damn thing? You can't. No dungeon stands up to that.
And we actually was, because we didn't die, and we played this over the three or four sessions, we actually were able to get in quite a bit of RPing as well. Because I remember my character changed sexes due to...
there was a gate or a portal or something, and the first time you went through, you were the opposite sex.
Yeah, and my character ended up preferring that.
Yeah, and you were fine with that. We had was that our first LGBT character?
Possibly. Well, I mean, I would say it's complex. Maybe gender fluid or something.
So somehow, every time you went through, both your gender and your alignment would change.
Yes.
And you were very uncomfortable when your alignment changed.
Not so much when the gender changed.
No, not so much when so when your alignment got back to good, you were like, okay, I'm done.
Yeah.
And I'm okay being female. My alignment's back to good. I'm done.
Yeah. That's basically, I guess, the mindset that I bring to the game. I always want to play a good player, preferably lawful good. I think just because I can really get into it, and I could find myself going to a deep, dark place if I didn't do that.
Fair. So I'd set the game up properly. I'd set it up to allow for the maximum of fun, you know, with the dwarves. No deaths. We had interesting encounters with the various, how do I phrase this, interesting twists that Gygax included, like the gender swap / alignment swap, gates or portals, whatever that thing was. Let's talk about the certain death traps. And warning, spoilers ahead. If you can spoil a dungeon written that long ago.
40 years ago?
So it was written for the tournament in 75 and then released commercially in 77. So
42 years.
42 years ago. Wow.
I was just guessing.
Anyway, so...
I've read Of Dice and Men since you have.
Oh, what a great book. So let's talk about the certain death traps, and like I said, spoilers ahead. The Sphere of Annihilation in the mouth of the statue.
I don't remember that one.
So there was a statue that had the big open mouth,
yeah,
and it was just the right size that someone could crawl into it. That the inside of that mouth was a sphere of annihilation. And thanks to the sphere of annihilation basically having a pop culture presence, you guys, Mike, I think, had watched a documentary called The Dungeon Masters, which is I don't love the documentary. It's a bit of an unfair slant on Dungeon Masters, but the documentary has its moments. Overall, I've watched it. But there's a part where one of the dungeon masters that they interview, they follow four dungeon masters, and one of the guys that they interview talks about the Sphere of Annihilation in his game and how it ended a party. Mike had been aware of that. So as soon as the statue shows up with the mouth, he was throwing stuff in there, and, you know, do I hear anything? Like, and nope, he noped out of that. He stayed away from the sphere. So the Sphere of Annihilation didn't get anyone.
So he cheated in a way.
Sure. He brought some metagame knowledge in. But he did test it scientifically.
Yeah.
The other certain death traps.
I was going to say, did we have a control in place? Would we have a simultaneous game going where we didn't test it?
Oh, we should have.
Yeah. We need to get another DM.
But I guess his control and experiment where we're throwing things in there and listening for sounds and poking a 10-foot pole in there to see what happened. Anyway, the other death traps were the false entrances.
Yes.
There was the one false entrance that had the ceiling that was weakened and would give way. And the module actually calls for a spot check or a perception check. And you guys made that check and recognized what was going on. So you purposefully collapsed it. And then there was another false entrance where the door behind you would close. And once it was closed, that was it. There was no way to get you out. And somehow you guys figured that one out or avoided that one. I think you wedged the door open.
Yeah, something like that.
Something like that. But really, very workmanlike approaches to every step of this dungeon and didn't die. There were a couple of combats. Gosh, we keep talking about gargoyle combats, but coincidentally, there was a gargoyle, a different gargoyle in this game. There was, of course, the lich combat at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Overall, the combats were good. They were interesting flavor. The traps were interesting. I think we had a lot of fun defining the workmanlike approaches. It was almost like you guys were writing macros for your characters.
Yeah.
And then telling me what macros you were running. Yeah, and executing them, exactly.
Control-Alt-G.
Yep. So we're going to make our way around this room. It'll take us a couple hours. Every time we get to a new 5-foot section of wall, we're going to hammer this in. We're going to do this. We're going to knock for hollow parts. And then we'll move 5 feet to the left. And a couple of traps, as you move 5 feet to the left, did spring on you. And it just happened to not take off enough hit points to actually kill you. So spears burst out of the wall. And you guys just, again, reemphasizing with no fudging, you guys just didn't die.
I mean, it comes down to our personalities, partly what we do professionally. So Chris is a developer. It's part of his job. He thinks in terms of algorithms and things like that. I think in terms of business process. Mike is just anal. It just made sense I'm not in hindsight shocked that we didn't die. Not that I think that we're that great. It's just that that just happens to be very conducive to our style of play seems to be very conducive to that that dungeon.
Yeah. So let's talk about that's the recap. Lessons learned. So the core negative lesson that I took away from this, it was a slog. I really if I was grading this game, I would give it a B-. Meaning, for the most part, very enjoyable, very fun. We had a good time. We laughed a lot. We had you guys on your own had this whole subplot going where you found so much freaking treasure in that dungeon that you were hiding it
yes.
from your dwarven counterparts outside.
And the basically our customer who had paid us to go in and basically, for lack of a better term, disarm the dungeon.
Yeah, to clear it. So you guys on your own had that whole story going. As you guys went out, you left the dungeon once to resupply at one of the wagons. And we had this subplot going. Do you remember this with the rival team? Because there were teams that got special hazard pay for going in first. And you guys had a rival team. I forget the name. I think I reused the name Ambershard from Falkrest to be the rival captain, the captain of the rival team, something Ambershard, Ambershard being his last name. You guys struck up a rivalry with him, so you had that going for you. We managed to find our own role-playing, find our own RP amidst this very mechanical module.
Yeah, we did. So I'm trying to remember how we actually interacted with the rival faction. Weren't we transported back outside a couple times naked?
That's right. Yes. Yes, you were.
Yeah, like through a portal or something, we were thrown back out, and I think the rival faction wanted to...
They were making fun of you, and they were like, oh, can you...
Yeah.
And I really played up the fact you guys had called him out as rivals, and I started playing it up, really getting into the RP saying, oh, if you guys want to sit this one out, we'll go in.
Yeah.
We'll take first crack. And you guys played it off pretty strongly.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun. When games go into the multi-session, now that we're doing bi-weekly, I think it's easier. But when we were doing things monthly, especially, multi-session isn't always the best, but I had fun with this all the way through. I think our RPing was good. I think the challenge of it was fun. Considering we were basically dealing with a dungeon, and I know we had encounters, but there weren't that many encounters, because our adversary was the Tomb of Horrors itself. But yeah, I thought it was great.
And finding our own RP. You remember the illusory collapse?
Yes, I do.
So there was the fake lich,
yes,
who triggered this illusion of a collapse, and you all ran out and you wait, and then you go in, and man, you guys were RPing fantastically, as I'm like, nothing looks collapsed, nothing this, nothing that. And then suddenly, and I think this might be the first time I ever curse on the show, so you might need to bleep this out, but suddenly Mike goes, son of a bitch, it was an illusion.
Yes.
And that moment was hilarious. We all died laughing.
So for whenever we actually end up playing some of our games, there will be cursing on that, so I'm not going to worry.
Oh my gosh, yeah, we curse so much during the games.
I'm not going to worry about that.
We don't curse when we talk to each other here, but in the game, we are dropping F-bombs and just reprehensible language left, right, and center.
Some games I may have to go back in and just recheck to make sure we don't say anything especially inflammatory.
Yeah. So for those listening at home, we tend to play, for the most part, when we can find time. Our weekends are really sacred for our families. We have wives, we have kids, we have pets, we have extended families, so it's tough to spend a weekend on a game. We do it every so often. So we game Thursday nights after work. And after work, man, I don't know what it is about being tired, being blitzed. It just makes you kind of silly and willing to say some dumb stuff.
And it's a good chance to vent on things that may be going on.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, to work some things out. Let's talk some more about some of the visual preparation I did. Do you remember these, Brian? So I'm holding up the Tome of Horrors. Originally, when it was first published, came with two booklets. There was a booklet of illustrations. And you could show the illustrations to the players from the illustration booklet without ruining the adventure. So I actually had bought the PDF of the Dungeons of Dread as well. And I printed all the illustrations. I cut them all out and I laminated them all. And I mean, this is like, gosh, 30 or 40 little laminated sheets of paper. Some of them are about the size of a 5x7 index card. Some are about 8x10. But every time a description of a room called for a picture, I would delve into this little folio, this little folder where I had all the pictures in number order, and I would hand you guys the picture, and we would pass these photos around. A ton of illustrations in this dungeon, and I'm so glad that I had printed and laminated these. This was a couple of hours of work, but completely worth it to be able to hand the picture out. Did that add anything to you?
Yeah, it did. And were these Gygax illustrations?
No, Gygax didn't actually do the illustrating. He was no, well, I don't know how good an artist he was.
I mean, it's not like it's not bad.
No.
It's simplistic by modern standards.
Sure. These are early adventures.
I mean, the reproductions, I mean, I know these were professional, but by looking at it, it's something like you would see out of a zine from the time.
Yeah, I don't see anything naming the illustrator, but I doubt it was Gygax. Anyway, yeah, these are quite good pictures, very good black and white pictures. In fact, the simplistic thing you said, Brian, my main takeaway from the Tomb of Horrors is, I guess it's been borrowed from and polished and reworked and re-edited and cleaned up so many times, and so many dungeons have borrowed from the Tomb of Horrors, that playing the original, it was noticeably clunky in parts.
Yeah.
Like there were things, mechanics, ideas, thoughts that noticeably had not quite been refined yet.
Yeah. I mean, it's not surprising. I mean, it was still basically a shoestring operation at that point.
So again, negative. I remember the last session. So this is where I've noticed, Brian, as I've re-listened to our episodes, that we have a theme. And one of our themes flies in the face of most modern dungeon master advice. Most dungeon master advice talks about staying away from metagaming. And a lot of our advice seems to revolve around, hey, sometimes it's okay to metagame. It's okay to put the AC up on the board. It's okay to put the hit points on the board. It's okay to show that, because you're just adding context that real people in the real world would have. And here's a metagame context. We were walking into the third or fourth, whichever session was the last session of this, and I remember saying, guys, I'm tired of this. One way or another, this is the last session.
Yeah.
We're going to find a way to get through this. today. And you guys worked with me, and when we became very workmanlike ourselves and knocking out the rest of the adventure and still having fun. So good episode to do, because I've busted a lot on dungeon crawls, because we had some pretty rough ones in fourth edition. This dungeon crawl was actually quite fun because of the way we'd set it up, because of the team of dwarves that specialize in busting through dungeons. I didn't learn a lot about running a dungeon positively that I didn't already know.
Yeah.
I did learn that three sessions of any one thing is too much.
How frequently did we play? Was there a month gap between, or did we actually try to speed this up?
So we did introduce one session to speed this up, because we had so much fun in the first session.
Yeah.
So we play bi-monthly now, meaning two times a month. At the time we ran this adventure, we only played monthly. So after work, it was the first Thursday of every month. And we introduced a Thursday in between, because we had so much fun with the first session and we wanted to make more progress. So we probably played through this over the course of 6 weeks.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Man, I had a lot of fun. I don't know that I would want to revisit it. I mean, not that I would want to revisit anything in particular, but I don't think I would want to play another game just like this.
No. In fact, as we ended the session, I remember Mike saying, "This was great. Let's not do anything like this for about 6 months."
Or at least 6 months, yeah.
Yeah, for at least 6 months. But that was all of our thoughts. Like, hey, this was great. It was a fun departure for us. Let's not do this again, which is kind of a shame. I never told you guys this, but there are other dungeons in this book that I really want to run.
But they're not designed to specifically kill you outright at every turn.
You'd be surprised.
Oh, great.
You'd be surprised. A lot of the older... So just the idea of a dungeon crawl in general is, I think, what Mike was talking about. Mm-hmm. And because this is called... Let me see here. Dungeons of Dread. It's four classic dungeon crawls. And Expedition to Barrier Peaks is a dungeon that I've always wanted to run. I don't want to tell you... So Brian, for those of you listening at home, I know you all know what Expedition to Barrier Peaks is. Or you probably do. Brian does not.
I do not.
And I don't want to ruin it for him, because I really want to run that concept one day. And even just the one sentence description of that dungeon kind of takes away the surprise that I want to give the players as they play through that.
So I want to hit on real quick. So I think this sort of speaks to the type of player that I am. And we talk about this before. I very much enjoy doing it. I enjoy doing this podcast, talking about it. I really get into it. But other than I like buying the guidebooks for whatever we're playing, I like buying dice. I don't do a lot of reading or studying on D&D campaigns or anything like that. Like, I can compartmentalize it where I can't necessarily compartmentalize other things. Like, I buy, again, guidebooks for what we play. You buy every guidebook.
Yes. So a couple of episodes ago, I said I had a shelf full of books, and that had been misinterpreted. Someone asked me, "Oh, so you have like one shelf on a bookshelf?" No, I have an entire bookshelf, top to bottom, left to right.
Yes, you do.
Filled with nothing but hardback books. And when I layer in all the box sets that I've bought over the years, the Dungeon Command boxes, the D&D board games, the minis, the maps, all the other stuff, I have a... You know those IKEA cube storage things, those Expedit
Kalax.
Kalax, there you go. I have a 5x5, like 5 cubby by 5 cubby Kalax filled with gaming stuff, in addition to the shelf full of nothing but books.
Yeah. In fact, I'm probably going to get the 3x5 if they have that, because I just have to replace another bookshelf, which Dusty pointed out that my bookshelf is broken.
Yes, here we are in RFC Studios, and I noticed that one of Brian's shelves was leaning. Thank goodness he was able to evacuate it before any of his extensive Transformer collection were damaged.
Sadness.
One other thing I wanted to point out as a lesson learned here. So I mentioned we didn't learn a lot because the session went more or less as I had planned, aside from the fact that no one died, which threw me. But it went well. We had fun. We laughed a lot. We found our role play. We had gelled a long time ago as a group by the time we did this, and nothing was particularly new here. But part of the reason we had such fun with this, famous meat grinder of a dungeon is the setup, is the fact that we departed from our regular characters for these sessions. We set up a completely different set of characters with different backgrounds where it would be okay if they died. We, you know, I set up an exact situation to enable a lemming meat grinder dungeon crawl without getting frustrated. Hey, build three characters. You're a member of this wagon train of dwarves, and the wagons are all full of tools and axes and sledgehammers and spikes and 10-foot poles and rope and any kind of hardware you might need. Because you are literally a company of dwarves that do this for a living, anything you might need, you basically have on hand right outside. Because I'd set that up, that enabled a lot of the fun. So I had the experience to do that setup to enable your fun. I recognized what would be frustrating about an adventure like Tomb of Horrors, and I headed it off at the pass.
You did. So thinking about this, so this was about a year ago, a little less than a year ago, I think. Mm-hmm. Because a year ago, I'd just been in this house like for 3 weeks, and this was nothing but boxes everywhere. So probably 8 months ago. Were we playing any regular characters at that point? I think we had just been going from one shot to one shot. I don't think we had played a regular character. Where I'm going is, I don't think any character that I've played over multiple games, I don't think any of them would have survived at all, because just the way that I play them, most of them are like hack and slash, you know, either they're quick to fight or quick to joke or something like that, but they're not very none of my characters are very thoughtful.
Yeah, and I don't think this dungeon is a place where any of your normal characters would even go.
No.
Like, hey, what's your character's name? Oh, we're playing the Pathfinder.
Ezrin.
So Ezrin, we're playing the Pathfinder Iconics because we're still going through, we're still leveling up to 5 in the beginner box, limiting our scope in our current game. If someone said to your current character, hey, Ezrin, there's this hole in the ground with super filled with traps.
I mean, it would have to be something where he was basically at spear point by someone who is several levels higher than he is.
Yeah, and he would have no motivation to go there. He'd have no reason to. Yeah. Hey, there's a ton of treasure there.
Okay.
Okay, yeah.
I'm a level 2 wizard. I don't care.
Yeah, he doesn't care. And he gets enough treasure in our current game, where I think we did the math. In the world of Pathfinder, Ezrin could live comfortably for a year what he's already got. So he has no real impetus to go and get ultra wealthy in some hole in the ground. So I had to do that setup with the company of dwarves that had been hired, and this is your freaking job, to eliminate any challenges you guys might throw at me about why is my character doing this, or I'm just going to get the hell out of this dungeon because, hey, that guy, Mike's character, just died. I have zero interest in doing the same. I'm going to nope out of here.
Yeah, exactly.
So I guess the advice here is, if you're going to run a module, and if you're going to run a famously meat grinder module like Tomb of Horrors, feel free to change the setup. Feel free to switch out the characters. Feel free to not play with your normal weekly characters, so that you can just have fun with what the dungeon is and not frustrate people on expectations that differ from reality. And the metagame pieces that I'm okay with, I've gotten more comfortable with metagaming over the years. It's setting those player expectations. Here's what we're about to do. Here's the type of adventure you're sitting down to right now. And that goes back to business, Brian.
Yes.
Every business meeting, tell them what you're going to tell them, and then tell them what you told them.
Yeah. Exactly right.
That's business. That's every meeting. No surprises. We're not reading a novel here. We don't want a surprise ending. You don't walk into a meeting with a CEO and build the narrative story that ends, you know, 5 minutes before the end of the meeting with, and here's what our sales numbers are.
Yeah.
That's not what you do.
Yeah.
You walk in and you say right away, you know, all right, CEO, here are our sales numbers. Here they are on a slide. Here's a summary. Now, let me tell you the story about how we got there. And that gives him or any audience a framework to hang the details on. Giving you guys the framework of, hey, you're entering this trap-filled area, gives you a framework to set your expectations on. And aligned expectations in business, in life, and in D&D are very important to enable productivity and fun.
Yeah, exactly right. Well said.
Anything you'd add, or are we done?
I think we're done.
Awesome. So next week, we're going to go back to what happened immediately after Cairn of the Winter King, and we're going to talk about the Tower of Waiting. basically my attempt to introduce a fortress, a stronghold for your characters in our fourth edition game.
Oh, yeah. That'll be fun.
Yep. All right. Tune in next week, rpglessonslearned.com, to see our episodes. All the subscription buttons are there. All the subscribe buttons are there. rpglessonslearned.com. Thank you for listening. People call them postmortems, evaluations, appraisals, reviews, retrospectives. We call them lessons learned, and we're sharing ours with you.